Everyone should have a hero, part 4, the end of their long, long trail for brothers in arms Harry and George Pike, by DJ M. Show me a hero and I will write you a tragedy, wrote F. Scott Fitzgerald. Since Harry had joined up in 1914 with the South Wales Borderers, he had seen almost continual action through to 1918. Regimental roles showed that his survival to this date was a statistical impossibility. This had a lot to do with the fact that leave for the enlisted man was rare. The average soldier got 10 days for every 15 months of field service, but as late as 1917, many men in the trenches had not been home in 20 months. From Gallipoli and on to northern France, the horrendous toll of dead, injured and missing relentlessly expanded. The army was bone weary. Its ranks, though, had multiplied, and weakened though they were, there were now more than 20 men in khaki for every one of the men of 1914 who had fought their way through the legendary retreat from Mons. However, the old professional army of the UK that always won the last battle, had fought at Quebec, Corunna, the Indies, had been trained in musketry at Hythe, drilled on the scorched parade grounds of Chudapore, was no more. It had been machine-gunned, gassed, and buried in 1915. Those holding the line now were the post-1915 old sweats, hardened veterans of the bloodiest industrialized conflict yet known to man. The British zone of Flanders operations was anchored by the towns of Armentières, Arras, and Albert. It ran from Ypres south, then gently east through the mines of Lens, past Vimy Ridge, across the Scarpe River and down to the Somme. Here millions of men lived, trained and died, in an area that measured some 50 by 60 miles, roughly the size of Lincolnshire. To the west was the sea, never more than 50 miles to the rear, and the staging ports of Etaples, Le Havre, and Rouen. To the east were the Germans. These were the 1917-18 killing fields in which the South Wales Borderers saw direct involvement, where those who perished were the ones caught on the barbed wire, drowned in mud, choked by the oily slime of gas, reduced to a spray of red mist, where quartered limbs hung from the shattered branches of burnt trees, bodies swollen and blackened with flies, skulls gnawed by rats, broken corpses stuck in the side of trenches that aged with each day into the colours of the dead. First Battle of the Scarpe. 9 the 14th of April 1917. Second Battle of the Scarpe. 23 the 24th of April 1917. Battle of Landmark. 16 the 18th of August 1917. Battle of the Menin Road. 20 the 25th of September 1917. Battle of Polygon Wood. 26 September 3rd of October 1917. Battle of Broodside. 4 October 1917. Battle of Poel Capel. 9 October 1917. Capture of Blonwood. 23 the 28th of November 1917. Battle of Estaires. 9 the 11th of April 1918. Battle of Messines. 10 the 11th of April 1918. Battle of Hazebrouck. 12 the 15th of April 1918. Battle of Bailleul. 13 the 15th of April 1918. In the spring of 1918, Germany and the Central Powers staged a final massive offensive that threatened to overwhelm British and French forces along the Western Front. Its purpose was to end the war swiftly by pushing the British Expeditionary Force towards the Channel, where it could be contained, before dealing a decisive blow against the French. The main objective was to break through the British lines in the Somme-Arras sector, where the numerical advantage for the German attackers was about 2-1, as the collapse of Russia had enabled the divisions stationed there to be shifted to the Western Front. The surprise offensive, aided by fog and Sir Douglas Haig's dispositions in depth, opened in the early morning of 21 March 1918 with a bombardment of unprecedented intensity. The Kaiser's battle had commenced. For almost 5 hours a barrage of over a million shells was poured into the British front lines, after which 32 divisions of German troops overran the southern section of the front. On the initial day of the attack, they captured more ground than the British had taken in the 140-day Battle of the Somme. Haig, commander of the British Expeditionary Force in Europe, issued the order, "Every position must be held to the last man." With our backs to the wall and believing in the justice of our cause, each man must fight to the end. On 24 March Haig indicated to his French counterpart that the British front line could no longer be held and he would have to abandon the defense of Amiens. In London, the cabinet panicked and even discussed the time it would take to pull the British army out of France. This was a harbinger of the Blitzkrieg of 1940, the evacuation from Dunkirk, and the bitterness that followed it. Remarkably, however, after retreating some 30 miles to the lines they had originally held in 1916, Harry, the SWB and the British Army held firm there and, despite being put under fierce pressure, forced the abandonment of German ambition and its adoption of a revised plan. Two German armies were ordered to overrun 9 Allied divisions, 8 British, including the SWB, and 1 Portuguese, that were between the German lines and the strategically important railway junction of Hazebrouck. Initially, the offensive that again commenced with heavy artillery fire on April 9, 1918 appeared to be highly successful. German troops smashed through the Portuguese defences but could not break the bloody-minded, stubborn British troops. It could be argued that it was here that the SWB finally broke the mighty German war machine, and brought the end of the war in sight, but that was not at all the view at the time of the exhausted and shattered British troops who were metaphorically out on their feet, awaiting the knockout blow. This never happened. The swift German advance over previously bitterly contested and shattered terrain left them dangerously stretched and presented many problems, not the least being how to resupply from railheads and depots across countless muddy quagmires, an inland sea of black waste and shell holes, strewn with carcasses of horses and men. British forces were accordingly able to reorganize, refit, and prepare, and on the 8th of August 1918 in northern France, a mainly British force themselves launched an attack on a 15-mile-wide front and advanced to a depth of 7 miles. In so doing, it inflicted 70,000 casualties on the Germans, capturing 500 guns while suffering 44,000 casualties of its own. The Battle of Amiens, as it became known, was the first clearly successful, large-scale, Allied offensive operation on the Western Front. Ludendorff, the German commander, famously called it the Black Day of the German Army. The hamlet of Autestein had been captured by the Germans on the 12th of April 2018, who retained control there after the First Battle of Kemmel, 17 to the 19th of April 2018. Forcing the German troops to retreat, it was recaptured by the South Wales Borderers on the 18th of August 1918. Some 900 prisoners were taken, but in the subsequent advance east beyond the village, and less than 3 months before the November armistice, Harry's number finally came up, 100 years ago to this day, on the far side of Autestein Ridge during unrelenting fierce artillery shelling. His body was never recovered, as with hundreds of thousands of others on the Western Front, he had been literally obliterated from the face of the earth by the awesome power of heavy guns and high explosive. The endless road moves to a darkening sky. A road where withered tress and shadows sigh. Across the years, where their memories lie. With friends long dead in Picardy. Thus came the end of a beginning. No golden voice of immortality. Sang Crispin's Day, but old men in their dreams will sometimes ramble with their youthful friends and mingle shadow with reality. Now they are gone. It matters not so long as not in vain. The ghosts of far-off friends should have died. His mother received a sympathy letter from the chaplain, 2nd Battalion SWB, dated the 31st of August 1918, and one from Sapper Carey dated the 2nd of September 1918. Son George also wrote to her from his Kew ship on 5 September 1918. There is no family record of any official notification, confirmation of Harry's death being received, apart from a typically dismissive letter dated 8 December 1920 from the War Graves Commission. Harry is commemorated, along with the names of 11,477 others from 36 divisions and 100 regiments, at the Plougstat Memorial, near Armentières, a covered circular colonnade, 70 feet across and 38 feet high, entered by an opening set between two stone lions. He also merited a mention in the local parish magazine. It was a terrible war, the most brutal and destructive conflict the world had ever seen. When it was all over, torture and cannibalism were the only two expedients that the civilized, scientific, Christian states had been able to deny themselves, wrote Winston Churchill, and these were of doubtful utility. On average, roughly 6,000 men were killed every day of the war. Before it was over, 9.5 million soldiers lay dead, millions more wounded. About half of the British soldiers fighting in France became a casualty of one kind or another. Even if one includes the men serving in the lines of support and communication, those on home defence in Britain, and British Army garrison troops in India and the Far East, it meant that of 10 men joining the army, 2 were destined to be killed, and 5 injured. Only 3 would survive the war intact. Intact? In war there are no unwounded soldiers. The figures take no account of the psychological effects of the fighting. Harry's brother George had lived through Gallipoli, Palestine, Egypt and the Atlantic to survive the Great War. However, in common with many of those who came home, the memories and awful trauma of his war service could not be erased. The chasm between those who knew and those who only imagined would be a defining reality of British life in the immediate years after the war, a current of memory and distinction flowing between the survivors, never spoken about but never ever forgotten. Many simply could not speak to those people who had not shared their experiences, much less cooperate with them. It was not that they despised them, they even envied them. But between those who had served and those who had not, there was a dark screen of horror and isolation, the knowledge of the reality of war. Across that screen there was no communication. They could only stand on one side, like strangers in a strange land. Unsurprisingly, George never settled successfully back in the UK. In spite of at one stage being appointed captain of the Duke of Westminster's yacht the Flying Cloud. He left the UK, with wife Hilda, for a fresh start in New Zealand. It was here that he effectively disappeared from the family record, just one more unseen insignificant victim of the war to end all wars. Transit Umbra, Lux Permanit. Copyright DJM 2018.